Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. For those who proclaim publicly, this is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry in the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania, where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse, unique perspectives to help prepare church leaders, teachers, preachers, pundits, proclaimers for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today is Josh Davis and Althea Spencer-Miller. Hello.
Greetings, everyone.
Hello, everyone.
We all hope that you are healthy and well, and that you are getting enough sleep these trying times, these challenging days. So today, we are looking at Proper 28, the Sunday closest to November 16th, and we are following along with some gaps, readings from Judges in Track 1 and Zephaniah in Track 2. But before we get into the text themselves, I have to pause and make the collect front and center of the little things that I'm saying at the beginning of our podcast discussion together. Because this collect is for somebody like me who has spent her whole life trying to understand, trying to read and absorb everything possible about Scripture. This collect is the center of that universe. Blessed Lord, who has caused all holy Scriptures to be written for our learning. Anyway, so you all know it, and if you're Episcopal, it'll be the collect for not this coming Sunday, but the next Sunday. And the way the collect, the collect by Cranmer puts digestion, inward digestion of the Scriptures front and center is how Anglicanism seeks to understand and prioritize Scripture. And there's a lot of imperatives in this collect. But the point of all of this action about Scripture is to embrace and hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life, which you have given us in our Savior, Jesus Christ. I just wanted to highlight that because it's such a beautiful collect for people who want to take Scripture seriously. Anyway, moving along here. The passage from Judges, we looked not long ago at the choice the Israelites were called upon to make by Joshua. And now it turns out that, like most of us, the Israelites again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and this resulted in them being sold into dependence and possible slavery. But the second paragraph in the selection of text from Judges 4, 1 to 7 is the identification of Deborah, who is a prophet. The translation wife of Lapidoth is possible, but it may also mean simply a fiery woman. She's identified as a judge in Israel, and she sits in a place of authority under the palm of Deborah in the hill country of Ephraim, and people come to her, you know, the court is in session. They come to her for judgment, and here's the judgment. She gives the word of the Lord to Barak, who is in charge of the army of Israel at that point, and here's what God says about this battle that is confronting you. And she prophesies the success of the army of Israel. I will give your enemy into your hand. So it's just something to note, a woman prophet. Psalm 123, a beautiful psalm of ascent, very much like pilgrims coming to Israel, pilgrims coming to the holy mount of the temple in Israel. It's a question of ascent. You go up to Jerusalem because Jerusalem is built on a hill, and hence the opening lines, to you I lift my eyes, to you enthroned in the heavens. And then there's a collective voice, so our eyes look towards the Lord our God until he shows us mercy. And here's this theme of mercy, loving kindness, compassion, delayed anger. We've been dealing a lot with anger in our texts and punishment and so on. So this is one antidote to that. Zephaniah is like last week's prophetic passage from Amos, an identification of the great day of the Lord. This is the impending judgment. It's near, says Zephaniah 1. It's near and hastening fast. That day will be a day of wrath, a day of distress and anguish, ruin and devastation. clouds and thick darkness, a day of trumpet blast and battle cry. So I suppose there's that kind of language about war in this passage from Zephaniah. The epistle from 1 Thessalonians 5 moves from the introduction, which we read recently, or concerns in the epistle itself. We read the introduction several weeks ago, but concerns about those who have fallen asleep. Now, concerning the times and the seasons, Paul, Silvanus, and Timothy write in 1 Thessalonians 5, you know very well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. So where people say there is peace and security, then sudden destruction will come upon them. So there's a kind of deceitfulness about public announcements, and there'll be no escape from the day of the Lord. But you, Thessalonians, to whom this letter is written and to whom we have already preached and traveled to several times, you are not in darkness. You are all children of light and children of the day. We are not of the night or of darkness. So let us not fall asleep as others do. And then there's an exhortation, a paranetic section, not to be sober, not to be drunk, not to get drunk at night, and put on armor, the breastplate of faith and love and helmet for the hope of salvation. The parable of Matthew 25, the second reading from Matthew 25 that we are in the middle of from the last week and this week and then the week following, is a parable that has sometimes been called the parable of the talents. And this parable describes a person going on a journey who entrusts talents in different amounts, 5 to 1, 2 to another, and 1 to the last, begs the question about what is the metaphor for which talents are a substitute. I'm just going to jump right in and say, this is a parable addressed to disciples. We are in the period of waiting, as we saw with the wise and foolish virgins, and somebody, the owner of the household, is going to, having gone on a journey, come back. And what you have done with what you have, in other words, the teaching that Jesus has been giving to you for 24, 25 chapters of Matthew's Gospel, starting with the Sermon on the Mount and so on, what you do with that can be shown in 3 different ways by the conduct of each of those slaves, each of those servants. And the judgment that the master brings, yes, it's harsh, it's harsh. And this looks like a harsh aspect. But we've seen the harshness of the story of the wise and foolish virgins, where the ones who didn't have any oil just didn't have any oil when the bridegroom returned, and they were without oil and in the darkness. So there is judgment about on the lips of the master to the wicked and lazy slave. So darkness, judgment, these would be themes, but above all, scriptures that are for our learning, and which we spend some time, as we do in this podcast, reading, marking, learning, and inwardly digesting. So what would you like to pick up?
The one thing I have, I'm now noticing, it's, you know, the lectionary aligning itself with the liturgical seasons and moving us into this period of preparation for the coming Advent. So there's a preparation, there's a preparation for preparing and waiting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like prepare to wait for 4 weeks. It is a strange rhythm to the liturgical year, but that's really what it is. And some denominations, some churches, some different Anglican traditions about Advent. I mean, in the UK, I think it's fair to say that what Advent is given over to in certain UK churches is carol services, you know.
Oh,
because you have hundreds of people, let's say in the City of London, who want to hear carols, because what is Christmas if it isn't carols? So we can't all do Christmas on Christmas Eve, and we certainly can't be together in a time like this. So distancing in many different carol services is going to be for many people in the Church of England, the experience of Advent, you know, which is a peculiar kind of way of preparing, but that's right. What Christmas is for many people. I don't know, Josh, what happens at your parish?
Well, our parish is new, so it's new
that's
to
great.
Us. So
that's great.
We will have to learn what the traditions are, what the expected traditions are too.
But you can you can do them yourself too.
Yes.
You can
yes.
plead ignorance.
Oh! Right. One of the things I wanted to ask the two of you about is this. This is something I suppose I've always wondered about, but the darkness, the thief in the night, and the children of light and children of darkness, the we're not of the night or of darkness, these seem like tropes. And then he carries it on into stay awake and be sober, those that sleep at night. Is there a reference that's behind this that he might be? I mean, Jesus makes similar sorts of connections, but it definitely seems like it's, I mean, even uses the same metaphor in places, but it seems like there's something behind it, like a folk saying or something along these lines, because it what I find interesting about it is that it reads like it's metaphorical and then it seems to get literal, and then he shifts to a military image, right? Put on the armor, the breastplate of faith and love, and the helmet and hope of salvation. I was wondering if maybe those are connected in ways that I don't see, or just something like that.
I think, I'm not sure if there's a source of the trope. I agree, it is a trope. But I think it's also at Qumran, you know, the children of light versus the children of darkness. So it's not just it's in different forms of Judaism. Althea, does that seem accurate to you?
It does, and I don't know that I could give anything more detailed except to think about the Jewish apocalyptic tradition that would also use tropes of light and darkness in some of the literature. So just to think about it. As you're saying, Josh, a popular trope, but one that also finds its way into the literature, the Qumran literature, and perhaps the apocalyptic literature too.
Thank you. It seems like it's so it's easy to move from light to being children of light to being children of the day and children of night, children of darkness being. And then into the night. And then he carries that over into drunkenness. And I'm wondering if is that a continuation of the metaphor? Or, I mean, are we to think that this is literal? And then how do we get from that to like the middle? It's just a mixing of metaphors. So it's an interesting passage, I think.
Yeah. 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 Not quite sure how much more I can say to that.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. And I don't have anything to elaborate on it, just to underscore that it is an interesting question. And there's a sense in which the mixed metaphors, maybe Paul got enthusiastic at this point.
it's
uneven.
Sylvanus had one armor metaphor, and then he got added to this as well.
Yeah.
One of light. But remember, 1 Thessalonians is the first, as far as we can tell, who knows exactly what's the first, middle, last. But if it's the first, you can imagine that different things will be tried out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't.
Because he comes back to the armor metaphor in, what is it?
Ephesians.
Right.
Yeah, and of course Ephesians is possibly Pauline, but Deutero-Pauline. Yeah, exactly. Right. So it seems to have taken off in certain circles. Yeah, exactly.
So eager to use the light and dark metaphors and the armor metaphors and maybe they get worked out over time in the tradition.
It's interesting because it does move to a kind of militaristic metaphor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, one of the theories about apocalyptic literature and apocalyptic thought is that it comes from people who are experiencing social dissonance and mm-hmm. some kind of sense of siege or a sense of otherness that accompanies it would help to make sense of moving towards breastplates and helmets. You're in an army, you're in a fight, you're in a challenge for which you need some form of defense system. Right. But then it's not only a mixed metaphor in the text, in the passage itself, but you know, you don't think about faith and love as breastplates.
Right. Not
salvation as helmets. So picking up these sort of ineffable virtues and concretizing them in this way is also an interesting move literarily.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and moving between children and people wearing armor too.
Yes.
You know, children of light, children of the day. And then suddenly becoming adults, putting as daylight people, you know, the full regalia. Yeah, that's a bit of a stretch as well.
Yeah.
And all of these are such familiar. Part of the reason why I would ask the question is because these are such familiar biblical images that a lot of times we don't stop and interrogate them, and sometimes they mean things slightly different than what we take them to mean, and just wonder where they come from and how one thought leads to the next and what's going on there. So,
yeah. And it is continuing a theme of horror.
Right.
By horror here, I'm thinking about last week's readings where there were serious and potentially harsh consequences for missing the moment. But here, it's God has destined us not for wrath, but for obtaining salvation. So the wrath sort of lingers in the air, but it's something that can be escaped with the right armor.
The right community. Because encouraging one another, you know, when we don't have a champion, you know, we have to build each other up.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is that would dovetail very interestingly with the Old Testament reading from Judges, because
yeah.
the story of Judges being this kind of consistent story of, you know, being faithful, becoming unfaithful, being attacked by a foreign enemy, repenting of that, and becoming faithful again, and then rising up a hero, a prophet, judge, military leader to rout the enemy, and then the same process occurring again and again until it reaches the horrible ending of Judges, right, where everything is dark. That really does track with this this apocalyptic perspective that you were giving us, Althea.
And I like the connection you made to Josh, that that there, in the sense that there's no Deborah here.
Mm-hmm.
So rightly, it's now the community building each other up.
Mm-hmm.
But Deirdre, I was also intrigued by your take on Matthew 25:14-30. I think it was very helpful to contextualize it in terms of discipleship and expectations of disciples in a text where we're talking now about preparing for final things. I was looking at it a bit and found it helpful too, because you start with the chapter starts with the 10 virgins, mm-hmm. wise and foolish, and there is the challenge of belonging to the right community and making sure that belonging is anchored,
mm-hmm.
and then using the teachings that you have received,
mm-hmm.
in a meaningful way, and that it all ends in the judgment of the nations, where it's now more than. I might be jumping ahead, but it seems right. Like it's more than it's reaching to an acme, where you move yep. from your own the a certain kind of preparation, have your oil ready to yep. make sure that you have utilized stuff, and now you're getting a sense of what is the right way in the judgment scene to use those to use your community, to use the gifts that you have been given.
Yep. 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 And it connects with the collect, you know, Holy Scriptures given for our learning. You know, what is our learning? Well, here we get three different ways as metaphors for understanding, internalizing, digesting, deploying
yeah.
how you have perceived everything in the gospel as a disciple yeah. up yeah. to this point, up to yeah. this point. I mean, you remember Matthew 13, the parable chapter is just with a focus on disciples. At the end of it, Jesus says, have you understood all of this? And they look at him, you can imagine it. And they say, yes.
Yeah.
One of the most optimistic responses one can imagine. So, you know, so here comes Matthew 25. Okay, so you've understood the whole thing. Okay, so off you go, deploy what it is you've actually heard.
Yeah. And dancing between 1 Thessalonians and Matthew again, it's like the quality of living in this in these communities of faith has a level of it's of implied intolerance, or maybe more than implied, especially in Matthew, implied intolerance for being idle. There's an urgency about this kingdom that Jesus has introduced, that Paul has entered into. There's an urgency to produce fruit. Let me borrow that metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is no room for the persons who aren't doing it quite right. Mm-hmm. The one who buries the talent.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what this is about. It's, you know, put your light on the hill, let it shine, that mm-hmm. people can see your good works. And that's part, you know, if you put the two of them together, that's part of being light. But having said that too, just a caveat, you know, in Christian history, in many of our mainline denominations, we've not been very good at addressing persons who are alternatively abled.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't want to play into that prejudice when I emphasize this aspect of being active, because there's also implicit what you have received that you use in Matthew 25. So there's room for all kinds of persons to be up and doing. Just don't sit on it. Don't bury it.
Yep.
There's a social background here too, which is worth pointing out. You know, slaves at the time, right, would oftentimes be put in charge of persons who were property of others would be put in charge of more property as a way of managing that property. And it's my understanding too that this was a way in which certain people could move up in society. So it seems like there's something like that going on here as well. But this is one of those parables that can be somewhat disturbing because of the way that you've got somebody, you know, who's eager to protect the master's property, who is being condemned and sent out, and what he has is being taken away and given to someone else. I think there's a lot of there's a lot of ways in which this could be interpreted to justify some bad behavior. And I think oftentimes is, and I'm not sure that that's what this is actually, what's actually going on here. And in fact, it seems like it may be ironic in some ways, like if these are conditions under which a lot of the people that would have been drawn to Jesus's message of the kingdom would be live, those would be the circumstances under which they would be living. And I wonder what, how this might have been read by them. Does that question make sense?
Yeah. And I'm glad you pointed out that possibility. I, you know, where we locate the Jesus movement in that society, is it a countercultural movement? Is it a culturally critical movement that is critical of the mores, the practices, especially the unjust practices of its society and its time? Because if it's any of those countercultural or culturally critical or even politically critical, then it would be difficult to read this as an acquiescence to a status quo where masters sort of crack the whip and expect undying allegiance. And expect the slaves to give everything that they have for the master's benefit. Rather, it would locate it in a value system. And we've been pushing this matter of being in community, encouraging one another, building each other up, doing the right thing by each other that we can thrive. If that's a value paradigm that's at work, then it's really difficult to with integrity in relation to the text, sustain an interpretation that encourages exploitation and absolute proprietorship.
Mm-hmm. Right, because not only are the talents that's handed over by the master property, but so are the slaves. In Roman law, they are not persons. They're things. Yeah. They're called things. And so there's something going on here in terms of property and things like this that are interesting, that it doesn't seem to me to be straightforward that Jesus is just underscoring or propping up this sort of arrangement, but maybe describing the nature of I think it has something to do with social relationships and debts and things like that. That it's still somewhat confusing to me, but I think important, because I think that this is exactly the kind of a parable that could be used by a boss to exploit a worker, for example, and to point to these words of Jesus as justification for that, as this is how God is. And that's the way things are set up in our society, and Jesus is drawing on the way things were set up in his society. And how would this have spoken to those people living under such conditions?
Yeah. I wonder if we could pore over the text with those thoughts in mind, pore over the text and ask the question, how are the slaves benefited in this? You know, and I can hear some colleagues asking, what is a liberative note
right
for the slaves in this passage? Because it really barely balances on the fence, and it can go either way.
Mm-hmm.
While we're thinking about that, just to go back to the point you were making about 5 minutes ago, Althea, about differently abled people. So in chapter 20, when Jesus gets to the temple and overturns the tables of the money changers, and he quotes, "My house shall be called a house of prayer. You have made it a den of robbers." Right after that, the blind and the lame, Matthew 21, verse 14, come to him in the temple and he cured them. And when the chief priests in Jerusalem and the scribes there see the amazing things that he did, and heard the children crying out in the temple, "Hosanna to the Son of David," they become angry.
Yeah.
So they're there, differently abled, in the holiest place. And they're noticed and they're attended to in a chapter not very far away.
Right. Can you elaborate on that?
If I can give that a stab, let me be careful about my violent language. If I could give that a try. It's a way in which the Jesus does this work of healing for those who would otherwise be on the margins of society by dint of a different kind of ability, what we would normally call disability, but a different kind of enabling that they have. So in healing them, Jesus pulls them back into a place where they can be more readily received. I don't know if I'm interpreting you right, Deirdre,
yep.
But it would seem then that that it enhances the idea that a passage like Matthew 25, given Jesus's work with these folk, should not be regarded as one that excludes persons who do not have the same level of capacity for production.
Yes.
You don't tie them in to the lazy one who hid. If you're doing an analogy, you don't tie them in or connect them to the one who is described as wicked and lazy. So that the instinct for inclusion of all in the possibility of productivity is implicit when that passage is brought in relationship to this one that Deirdre is doing.
And I think we also, thank you, Althea, need to take into account the transformation of the temple, that the overturning of the tables of the money changers is symbolically supposed to represent. Mm-hmm. It's an action that causes fierce counter reaction, mm-hmm. because yeah. it looks like the undermining of a system, a religious system. And it doesn't set in place an alternative system, but it is a symbolic action that portends that the temple will not be sustained. And indeed it wasn't.
And right. And so if you think about, you know, Jesus's kingdom being one of, you know, the differently abled, the previously demonically possessed, right? I mean, these are not productive slaves, yeah. you know,
yeah.
That's, yep. that's kind of the point. And so if the message is to them, you're going to be cast out. I mean, that's what the Beatitudes say. It, there's a reversal with regard to those things.
Yep.
How ought we to, or what ought we to make of this? Who are the folks to whom something has been entrusted and very little returned, right?
Yep.
That seems to be the, right, if we think about this from the perspective of the Beatitudes, then it would be the poor who are the slave that has been given the 5 talents
yep.
and returned another 5 and yep. then had the 5 taken from the 2 or what it was. I don't remember, but I don't remember the details here, but the one servant that just held on to it had those taken away.
Yeah.
It would be more like we'd be thinking that those that were responsible for stewarding the temple would be the ones that would have what they had taken away, right?
Yep.
Given elsewhere.
Yep. I wonder if the wicked and lazy slave might also be the weeds in the parable of the wheat and the tares.
Mm-hmm.
These tares exist, they just exist to the astonishment of the other servants who observe that these have sprung up alongside wheat. And the instruction is to leave them alone until harvest. Could this be a kind of anticipation of the angel sorting out the wicked and the bad fish, right. the tares as well? I'm thinking always in terms of parables interacting with each other and...
Mm-hmm.
And that may be one.
Yeah, maybe one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm also thinking that may, yeah, I want to support that. And at the same time think that there must be such people in the community, sort of pulling on that the wheat and the tares are growing together. There must be such people in the community who are wicked and lazy. I actually began to think of people who sit on committees, rarely ever come to meetings, and hardly ever do any work.
Yeah.
They're ashamed when things happen and there's activity, they're named because, well, they're
yeah.
But
yeah.
I am also thinking about the function of this this parable. It's I'm hearing the ambiguity in application that Josh is talking about, because it's a parable that has to, whatever the audience that receives it, they have to connect it with a system that they live in, and an exploitative system, and one that doesn't value them. But at the same time, it's a parable organized in Matthew in such a way that it speaks to the Matthean grip on eschatological hope in among the Jews. I'm not sure what other groups might have had this kind of eschatology working, but for sure I know the Jews did. And there is a sense, it's there in 1 Thessalonians, that this is an atmosphere of crisis where something has to give, something has to change, and the hyperbolic language of apocalyptic and eschatology captures that sense of this is a moment when things can't be the same. So there's a rhetoric of encouragement and a rhetoric of discouragement. A rhetoric of encouragement that says, you've got to get going. You know, you've got to be doing things. This is what we're committed to. This is who we are in this time. Let's stand for the Matthean things we know we stand for. There is no time and space for wheat. There is no time and space for laziness. This is not what we can be at this time.
The entering into the joy of the household in which these persons function is repeated twice. And of course, the one who hears the word and receives it with joy is the description of someone in the parable of the seeds and the sower in Matthew 13. And it's also the way in which the state of mind, the state of being that the magi enter into the place where Jesus is born in the beginning. So, of course, the magi are completely outside this entire structure. So entering into joy, yeah, the repetition seems to me to signal something bigger than the immediate context.
Yeah, and just playing with the question of how would they have received it?
The joy.
The parable, actually.
The parable.
On the whole. I'm not going to guess at that. but I am thinking what it means to live in an atmosphere of expectation.
I was going to say, if you paired this with the parable of a dishonest manager, mm-hmm. which, you know, if you read this parable straightforwardly and you read that parable straightforwardly, they would appear to be contradictory in a sense, because I mean, by straightforwardly, I mean, as though this is just what is being recounted here in Matthew 25 is just simply an underwriting of these social relations as they exist, and that this is the way things ought to be, and that you take it as a guide for how for our behavior. You know, when I'm put in charge of things, or when I'm responsible for managing other people, I should manage them just like this, because this is what God expects, right?
Yep.
But the dishonest manager would suggest the opposite, and there might be a way to read, okay, so who are the, who really is, and this may be the irony of it, right? That he praises the dishonest manager, and the Lord, the master, praises the dishonest manager for being so shrewd in basically, you know, robbing him of his property and giving it away, but doing so in a way that it, at least for him, for the manager, increased, rather than destroying relationships, it built them up for himself. so that when the relationship with the master was severed, he had a place to go. He had people who were willing to take him in and celebrate him as a hero or as someone who had transformed their circumstances by writing off their debts. Maybe in a situation like this, there's a way to understand what increase means here in those terms.
I just want to pause and note that that's in Luke. It doesn't mean you can't apply it, but it just means that there's a complexity of life in Luke. The dishonest manager is commended for his shrewdness, because the sons of the world are more shrewd than the sons of the light. You know, we've got that imagery of the community as sons of light, but the commendation of the treatment of the debt from the sons of the world is what the master is commending. But it's the moral ambiguity of this that makes it a Lucan parable. But I appreciate that it's all told by Jesus, and it fits into the parable telling that is at the heart of Jesus' proclamation of God's realm. But there's more time to work things out in Luke. There's more emergency in Matthew.
More emergency, yeah.
Yeah.
And Luke does at times have that kind of ambiguity.
That's exactly the point. Better to be rich for the sake of the kingdom. You know, the guy who built up the storehouse and the barns, and his life was required of him the very night that he finished building the barns to store the healthy harvest. Fooled, this night your soul will be required of you, and so on. But better for people to be rich towards God. But not to store things up for themselves. It's the self-absorption that is so characteristic of Luke's gospel.
I think Josh has been troubling something in this Matthean passage, and I've been working hard to avoid it. and bringing that in, and with your comments, Deirdre, I wonder what it's like to sit with the discomfort that this passage brings, the discomfort that is grounded in its ambivalence, its potential ambivalent application. That on the one hand, you have to them and us might have to contemplate the possibility that this could lend itself to structures and practices that we would now regard as unfair and unjust. But on the other hand, knowing how we think about what's fair and just, to lean into the values orientation of the passage, the community orientation, the urgency of the time, but not resolve it in terms of one or the other, but to recognize grappling with this might very well, grappling with that ambiguity might very well be the exercise we need to build muscles of discernment and muscles of commitment.
I completely accept I wasn't thinking about the different gospels in which it appears, but I think the question that I'm exploring is not so much what does Matthew or Luke mean, but how would the people have received, living in these structures, how would they have received this? And it's difficult for me to, I mean, obviously maybe we don't know, but it's difficult for me to see Jesus preaching to people that lived in situations like this as something that was good news. And maybe I don't want to think that because I'm aware of the ways in which passages like this have been used in chattel slavery to underscore what's clearly, I mean, which is clearly inimical to what we proclaim as any sort of good news.
Yeah.
And so I hear the point about urgency for Matthew versus ambiguity for Luke. And I think it's a very important point, and I don't want to oppose it. I just, the question that's before my mind is how would this have been received at the time? And maybe it's just a parable that means something to Matthew's community in which he's trying to underscore a particular point of urgency about, like, you know, what that might be, accepting the gospel versus continuing the accepted understanding of the traditions of Judaism or something like that. But it definitely is it's definitely a retributive image, in relationship to in a society that was based on a debt economy, and which all across the Gospels in various ways, Jesus is teaching things that are at odds to that form of debt exchange, and this looks like one where it's just being reinforced in its status quo. That's the question that I'm exploring here, and that I find most disturbing, because if I can't solve that question, then I don't know exactly how to think about, or if I don't have a way of thinking through the connection across what we understand the teaching of Jesus to be, then with our own history, applying a passage like this today can be particularly dangerous.
And let me just clarify. I didn't disentangle myself enough from the Lucan ambiguity to make it clear that I was not thinking about the Matthean audience in its imperial setting, also being able to perceive what could be described as ambiguity in what you're saying, that they too lived with these practices in their time, in the imperial setting, in their Jewishness, in the Jewish system. They would see this kind of practice, the master-slave relationship, the property-servant relationship, the possibility of being promoted by dint of how you produce for the master, that they would be able to recognize that in their society, as well as see the good news that Jesus is preaching, that they've been learning about, and have to live in a situation where they're making a decision as to how they're going to hear it. They might have a teacher with them who could explain it very specifically, which way you're supposed to go with this. And maybe clarity is achieved when you get down to Matthew 25, 31, and later in the eschatological scene. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking that the very audience of Matthew would have seen with two eyes what it is that you're describing, Josh. So does that create more of a quandary?
No. I think it's one we have to own. I have sometimes asked myself, where does Jesus anywhere in the New Testament, where anywhere does he speak to a slave? And I don't have an easy answer. I don't find a simple and quick solution to that. In other words, there is something liberative about the commensality, the table fellowship of the message that Jesus proclaims about God's kingdom and the inclusion of that and the difference of it. But there is also something that is not simply an embrace of peasant society, an embrace of the underclass. It's not straightforward to ask a question, where does Jesus speak to a slave, and not be able to answer it?
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons why I also mentioned that, I believe sometimes people would sell themselves into slavery as a means of moving up in society, right? I mean, after a certain period of time, if you've been a good slave, you come out on the other end of it, not a slave, with some property that you may not have had before. And so there is a further ambiguity in that regard as well. But it also seems to me that there's a how to put this. It's like the master the debt is flowing one one direction, right? From the slaves to the master. They're in charge of something. They're not being given something in the sense of, like, there's no gift being given to them. They're just in charge of something. And they are themselves property. So the last one that doesn't handle it well will just be, lost the opportunity for advancement, which was given to them, right? And I suppose what I mean is, I was thinking about a difference of slavery in that time than chattel slavery. I don't know what conclusions to draw from that, is other than the fact that this is very complex to think through and receive and think through its implications today.
Yeah.
Right? I think you're right to make the distinction between slavery then and chattel slavery as we think about it in later our colonial times. One of the clues that one can follow and do some work on slavery, research on slavery in that time. Because a person might sell themselves into slavery for social promotion, but they might also sell themselves into slavery in order to settle a debt
with
someone. But the freedom to go and trade is not something that we would associate readily with chattel slavery.
Right.
Certainly not trading on behalf of the master. It seems to me it would have to be some very special, highly trusted slave in chattel slavery that might be allowed to do something like that. But it's so easily passed over in these passages that the one who received 5 talents and the one who received 2 talents, well, certainly the one who received 5, they just go off and trade with whom? Mm-hmm. How? Mm-hmm. In the marketplace, with moneylenders, with whatever the financiers of that time were. Did they have a stock market? How did they have such direct access to that? So in a sense, you point to a challenge we have of how to understand the term slave and what it signifies in terms of social access, societal access, societal status, education, and so on and so forth. Because to do that trading, either these slaves, who I always assume are men, but they maybe could have been women too, that these slaves had to have, they had to have numeracy. At least they had to be able to add 1 and 1.
Yep. Yep.
And 2.
So right. Yeah.
Yep.
There's a level of education there. And in this case, they had to be able to multiply. So there's a level of education there that cues us. But then it also points to the complexity of Roman society, that we just can't translate our class terms into that society very readily. There's some modification that might need to be done. But Deirdre, I also thought, where Jesus has crowds following him, the motley class collection that might be in that crowd,
yep,
would be an interesting unraveling to do. To
yep.
answer that question, where does Jesus talk to anybody other than those in need of healing and his disciples?
And as you were speaking, I sort of realized that one of the things that I think about here is that I tend to, even though they're called slaves and I think about slavery as a bad thing, I also tend, when I read this passage, to think of them as like middle managers or mm-hmm. professional bureaucrats mm-hmm. for whom, like, maybe the appropriate analogy would be, you took out student loans to go to college, right? And mm-hmm. Now what did you do with that on the other side of that? Or something along those lines. But I believe I interrupted you unintentionally, Deirdre.
No, I don't think so. I think this is an important and good and difficult discussion.
Yeah, it certainly moved us away from just looking at this passage and thinking it was readily understandable.
I don't know if this would help preachers at all.
I if it just disturbs our complacency in the presence of a familiar passage, I think that's good.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And we're giving some material, Josh. I mean, I think that's what we can do.
Yeah.
So my takeaway is from all of this is, you have taken out your student loans, and some of you have been successful bureaucrats, and some of you have just gotten a job at McDonald's. And to those of you that got a job at McDonald's, even that job will be taken away and given to a successful bureaucrat, which I suppose is retribution enough, right?
I think I'm going to be a bureaucrat. Position.
All right. Perhaps we should stop there. Thank you very much for this great discussion that isn't going to solve all the problems, but which has surfaced many of them. And I look forward to the next time. And we wish everybody health and sanity in the days to come.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.